global meltdown. The financial world had a great part, and I was looking at the slide this morning, and there's an afro at the back there, and it hasn't been going since 1975. So, certainly over the last 5 years, it's been like that, where everybody's just been dancing and having a good time, and, you know, where was it going to end? It's one of those times, though, where when it was happening, everybody was saying, this will have to end at some stage. It's just that when it did, it was, you know, where did that come from? And why did it end? And everybody's now doing the soul searching. It's now over. Quite clearly, people are sweeping up the mess. And we're now seeing those who can drive home safely at the wheel, and those who can't. And with those who can't, it's, you know, it's like even when you're driving home, you haven't had anything to drink, and you see the flashing light behind you, the heart keeps happening. When did he last for him 3 days ago? Will there be a trace? And what you've got now is those who are okay, breath-wise, they're okay, go home so they have a safe trip. Those who are just on the border, get a caution, don't do that again. Those who are over the limit, go for the blood tests, get the big fine. And those who have to go to court because they've been drinking heavily, drunk at the wheel, repeat offender, you know, they get big rap over the knuckles, big fines. It's times like this, though, that it's almost you want Tracy Grimshaw to be the corporate regulator. Because I see it a bit like the 630 report, where they get outside their court, somebody gets the big fine, license suspended for 12 months, and just get straight back in the car and starts driving. And so we show them at 6:30 on prime time, but it keeps on happening. Will the same happen in our space? You know, will the people who generated all of this bad news in the past, all of this froth, you know, will they be put to one side, you know, in the sin bin, not to be seen again for some time? Like happened last time, this happened in the late 1980s, where the old, you know, Gordon Gekko, green is good times were really put to one side, or is it going to get back to business as usual sometime soon? I hope not. Why did the party last so long? Really, three reasons. Cheap money, people ignored risk as a result, and the regulators three steps behind. A dangerous combination. Whenever you make any kind of commodity cheap, if you don't have the regulatory framework around that to stop people abusing it, then they will be abused. That's the free market that we live in. And we've had cheap money, it risks being ignored, and the regulators literally three steps behind. Why was that so? Well, firstly, share prices rocketed. Those who were around in the 1987 crash, and that would probably be a third, half of the room's gone, maybe. I mean, that was a pretty big belting at the time. But you can see in the long-term scheme of things, it was merely a blip. Didn't feel like it at the time, but it was merely a blip in the long-term scheme. What happened after that, though, is to get from using numbers 2,000 to 3,000, or get back to where it was before this 2,000 even, it took 6 years to get back to the peak. To go from 2,000 to 3,000 took another 6 years. To go from 3,000 to 7,000 took 3 years. And total returns during that period were massive, you know, 20-30%. It was inevitable that that would come to an end, and largely speaking, it was because there was this wall of money. You know, you speak to people and say, what's driving this? It's the wall of money. What is the wall of money? Where's it coming from? I don't know, but it's there. It's like, no, where's the wall of money gone? I don't know, but it's gone. And it has literally gone. The liquidity issue has just gone from, you know, hero to zero in the space of 6 months. And as a result of that, there are people taking money out of the share market. The share market's been sold down. The size of the fall is less than last time we had a correction like this. It's the worst quarter in 20 years. But we had 10 pretty good quarters before that. You know, on a long-term trend basis, things are open. It's just that we've had this big spike in prices and we're now suffering a fall, a blip. You know, if you run your business for the long term and don't get, you know, hoodwinked into thinking that this blip is reality, then things should be okay. So people who saw that peak and saw it as being like this forever and keep on having an exponential graph, you know, there's bad trend because total returns can't keep on going on at that pace. Warren Buffett said the other day that if you want 10% total return, that means in the year 2100, the NASDAQ, or sorry, the Dow Jones would have gone from 12,000 to 2.5 million. You know, so these are scary numbers. At 20-30% per annum, it'd be some billion. It's unsustainable that the world keep on going up that kind of pace. The other issue as well, that money was too cheap and interest rates were too low. They were very low, I'll put it in brackets there, too low. We had this issue of the subprime loan era, what they call the Greenspan book. You know, financial services not doing too well, that's all right. We'll value out, we'll keep drop interest rates without putting the framework in place to stop bad things from happening and people abusing that money, then things are bound to go wrong. And wrong they did. In came the Great Crashes. This is an American website of the Predatory Lenders Association of America. Meet the working poor. Who are the working poor? The working poor are the new middle American middle class. This exciting, fast-growing demographic includes military personnel, most minorities, and a growing percentage of the middle class. The PLA also targets the retired poor, who often use payday loans for their prescription drug pays. And on the right-hand corner, this is how you make. You turn $500 into an annual percentage interest rate to the working poor of 456%. And it's no joke. This exists. Four Corners on Monday night. It's about, you know, a similar kind of thing in Australia. People lending money to people who have not got any prospect whatsoever of ever paying that money back. And when interest rates are 1% in America, as they were, in a market where traditionally it's been, you know, when you borrow for 25 years fixed at 6%, all of a sudden people come on and say, you don't have to do that anymore, you can borrow at 1%. All of these people moved into housing that shouldn't have been there. People were buying second homes, third homes, fourth homes. People were buying a home for the first time on these low-doc, no-doc subprime loans that they could never repay. Guess what happened? Why was that so? Well, there were plenty of prey to prey on. This is a graph showing the share of income of the top 10% in the United States going back to 1920. Before the Second World War, pretty much a two-tier society. You had the Great Depression, the New Deal, the war came along, and after the war you had these long decades of the middle class of America. And it's the same thing happened here, the middle class Australia. Mum, dad, two kids, mowing the lawn, holding the car. You know, you've seen all of these old footage from the 1950s and 60s. You've never had it so good because everybody was doing well. Sure, you still had, you know, a lower socioeconomic, but generally speaking, that was quite small. And people were doing well. It's the big middle class. The early 1980s, it started to change. I don't know if it's about politics or what, but it coincided with the old monetary policy, Milton Friedman, Ronnie Reagan type era. I mean, it's very much, you know, the greed is good, and people got greedy. And over that period, we've moved back towards how it was before, where in America, the top 10% control almost half of the wealth. And you have this growing working poor, underclass, who can't afford much, and with low interest rates, people preyed on them to go and buy things that they couldn't afford. And when interest rates went up, the whole thing went pear-shaped. This is a slight courtesy of UBS, who are actually in the room today, so I thank them for that, and I'd like them to explain it to me, because I've had three goes, so I still don't get it. But this is how you turn $100,000 of subprime loan in Cleveland, Ohio, or the Rust Belt of America, into $80 million of commercial mortgage-backed securities. No joke. $100,000 turns into $80 million. Magic. David Copperfield. The problem is that it's all now imploded. People are asking for the money back, and the people who owe the $80 million are looking back to the people who owe the $800, back to the original person who owed the $100,000, who's left that house a long time ago. It's probably been sold on eBay by now. And there's no money. They trace it all through, there's no money. It's not only have the people who are putting those homes can't repay it and have moved out and left all of these homes vacant in America, when you track it all through with the leverage on the leverage on the leverage, there is nobody to repay the loan. So not only are there these big write-offs that are happening, nobody actually knows where the money is in the rent. Scary graph. Wall Street Journal, US $1 sweeping revamp of credit market rules. Fantastic. Problem is, March the 14th, 2008. The horse hasn't just bolted, it's won the race. You know, it's done two laps. Massive issues here of, you know, and it's in the newspaper today, Henry Paulson, US Treasury, trying to pull all of this together, change the rules, the states are against it, and it's just bizarre. Those rules have been abused for so long now, the damage has been done. What they do now will fix it up for next time. And as long as next time we don't have the same kind of environment, we'll be fine, but we will. Somebody will break the rules next time, and the same thing will happen again. But the horse has bolted. In Australia, the horse has bolted. We're going to have an investigation into the mortgage lending market, credit markets and so on. Yeah, we should have done that 5 or 6 years ago. Every quarter, I fill in and sign my compliance plan as chief executive of Stocklinks. We're governed by the managed investment tax. It's about that thick. I'm proud of it. It's lovely work. Spreadsheets, words, and signatures, and all that kind of thing. we will never do anything wrong. I'll guarantee that. Why are we doing all of this kind of stuff when those same people who are regulating that can be out there stopping all of this bad stuff happening to ordinary people in the street who are getting played on? It's bad news. Same thing in America. All up to the edge. So here's the problem coming. This is such prime recess, and that's roughly where we are today. We've moved on a couple of months since then. And, you know, the worst is still to come. This is the recess when all of these small people have their mortgage reset at a higher rate and can't pay the money back and the whole thing goes to paycheck. So what's happening at the moment? I know what we'll do. We'll drop the interest rates. And that means that that will fix the problem because the reset won't be as large. But is that a smart thing to do? Or are we just deferring the inevitable there of this big underlying current of bad news that's below the surface? You know, maybe just dropping interest rates, maybe that's just papering over the cracks. Pump $200 billion in, get a bit of liquidity there. Well, that doesn't work. Or pump another $200 billion in. You know, at some stage, somebody's got to say, something is not working here, and we need to do something more fundamental and more structural about it. Otherwise, the same thing will just happen again. And it's now hit the fan. How far will it spray? And the big question is it going to spray to Australia? Or are we immune because we're all about China now? We just dig stuff and sell it to the Chinese and everything's fine. You know, America sneezes, we catch a cold, maybe we don't catch a cold anymore. The problem for us is that mining exports represent around about 6-8% of gross domestic product. 60% of the Australian GDP is driven by the consumer. We are a consumer-driven economy. In America it's 80%. It's what happens to the consumer in Australia that counts, not what happens to commodity prices or mining. Sure, that might help the consumer, but the multiplier effect of that is actually quite small, because there's not a lot of value add that happens to this stuff before they ship it off. So we are a consumer-driven society. And what do our consumers rely on? How much they earn, their job, and how much money they have left after the tax man and the mortgage provider has had their take. And that's a shrinking pot in Australia because of interest rates going up. But it's not about subprime this, subprime that. Everybody blames the subprime. I'll come to why I put this up there in a minute. It's not about everybody blaming the subprime. You know, overstockbroking goes bust. It's all about the subprime. It's not. It's because people are doing bad stuff. You know, or some of our competitors that blown up. It's all about the subprime. It's not. It's because they borrow too much money. It's not about subprime. Subprime is just the catalyst for all of this to happen. Subprime is the scapegoat for 2007. It's still the scapegoat for 2008, but as of April, I think we should just, you know, say let's call it quits on that one and actually face reality as to what, you know, is a good business and what is a bad business. It's those who are silly and those who are sensible. Giselle's sensible because she's the Brazilian supermodel, highest earning model in the world, and she rewrote her contract last year in euros, not US dollars. So if you're smart and looking like that, then you can get a new body in just one week, things have got changed. So what about the property sector? Well, there's three things I want to talk about today. Strong property fundamentals. You know, we call it as it is. We don't stand up on the stage and tell everybody things are fantastic when they're not. We will tell you exactly how things are. That's our job. There is good demand. There are supply constraints, and there are rising rents in all sectors, retail, office, residential. I'll talk about those in a moment. But can it last? Rising interest rates. I hope not. I hope that's the end of it, and the market's pricing in that that's the end of it. And you know, I really hope that that is the case, because I don't think the consumer can stand any more pain. I'll talk about that in a moment. Consumer business confidence is dropping. People are now worried about economic growth. People are saying we might have a recession in a couple of years. When you start talking like that, and the media starts talking like that, people start to believe it. We're 60% driven by the consumer, and if they believe it, don't feel confident, they don't spend, the whole thing starts to go like that, which is the point that I believe it from now on. There's also concern about values because of the credit crunch, the Centro contagion, forced sellers, you know, what will happen to values. I was in America recently and talking to our investors over there, and you know, they saw Australia as a safe haven, and they've been worried about. So they've taken money out because they're nervous. Convince us why you don't do that kind of stupid stuff, and we might invest in you. You know, all of our share prices have come down because of this contagion effect of people being nervous because of bad things that have happened in our industry. So firstly, with office markets, we have record vacancies. Vacancies have never been lower on the records that go back 25 years, nationally 3.5%. Perth and Brisbane have the lowest vacancy of any office markets in the world. The survey came out yesterday, 0.1%. 0.5%. 0.5%, that just about gives you time to fit the new space up for new people. That is full. And it's not just full. When you go and see some of these offices, the people are acting like silent. So even if there was more space, all that would do is just alleviate the fact that people are acting. And if you go and talk to the people who operate there, they would hire another 400 people tomorrow if they could get them. But they can't get them because the labour market is so tight. Similarly in Brisbane. So rents are going up. But what happens in times like this is that the people who pay the rent, a lot of you in the room here today, tenant advocates, this is unfair, terrible, landlords gouging too much rent. In real terms, rents are less now than they were in 1988, in real terms. Now, how many of your input costs are less now in real terms than they were in 1988? So this is just our day in the sun, so just pay the money and smile. As usual in our industry, we will build too much. On the back of this, everybody will get excited, rising rents, gee, I'll go back into the building again. And rents will stabilise at some stage, and you know the boot will be on your foot, that's the way the market works. Except, in this time, the barriers to entry have gone up, because costs have gone up. And they're not coming down. The steel, the labour, the material costs are not going to come down. There is a structural change in the barriers to entry, which means a structural change in rent. Because if you can't afford to build it, you won't build it. And now, you can't get any money because of the credit crunch. A lot of the people who were going to build things now can't build them because there isn't any money. So perversely, under credit crunch comes a barrier to entry, which means it will dampen supply and actually work more in the favour of people who own the buildings. That's probably the only good news that comes out of the credit crunch, that limitation on supply. So unlike 1989, 90, when this last happened, rents escalated, the whole skyline is full of cranes, now you can barely see anything. So good news from this market. So rents are rising, unlikely to change in the short term, and we're in some pretty healthy times ahead in the property space. In the retail, real wages growth, people are earning well, household income's going up. Retail sales growth, over the last 3 years now, has been growing by somewhere between 6% and 8%. You know, think about retail sales growth, which would be population growth plus CPI plus a little bit because people are more affluent. 6-8%, that's a lot. That's not that sustainable taking a long-term perspective. And the problem we have now is that the consumers are worried. Consumer sentiment on the back of the last interest rate rise dropped the most sharply it ever has in the last 15 years. Well below 100. Won't be there for a while. People are worried. They're worried because of general economic stuff. They're not yet worried about their job. Employment is still strong. When people start to worry about their job as well, that chart will fall quite dramatically because people are very, very obviously susceptible to what their income is. And if they feel nervous about their employment, which hasn't started yet, and I dare say won't to any dramatic extent because of this light labour market that we have, then yeah, things will get a bit tough. So I'm of the view, and I'm not just talking out of book here, that interest rates have done their work and it doesn't need to go any further. The consumer is already feeling enough pain. On to housing, well, the big housing conundrum. This is a chart brewing here, which is probably one of the toughest, most confronting charts that the Rudd government has in front of it. I would argue it's one of the charts that lost the coalition in the last election. Population growth is rising at its fastest rate for a long, long time. It's over 1.5%. Half of which is natural, half of which is immigration. In the last 2 to 3 years, the immigration part has gone up because of the 457 visas, the fact that we need more skill-based labour and so on, and you know, more people coming in. And immigration is now running at over 1.5%. That's a lot. You go to Europe, they die for 1%. Not literally, but they 1% is a good number. Then they've got declining population, whereas us we have population growth of 1.5%. Fantastic. Good for the economy. And if you said to the Australian people, which the government is obliged to do, do you want economic prosperity? Yes. Do you realise that to have economic prosperity we need good population growth because of the ageing demographic and the instant generation of equity? And we don't want to be like Japan where we've got two people working for every one retired person? Yes, we understand all of that. So do you support immigration? Kind of. But yes, we'll go with the flow. 1.5% that's houses, apartments, dwellings, call them whatever you like. Where you have a deficit, and this is the federal government's number, not mine, 35,000 dwellings per annum, we are in deficit. And that started a few years ago, so we have a deficit that's already there now. And it's growing at the rate of 35,000 a year, because we're not building enough. I'll come into why in a minute. And so it's a big structural issue. Last year, interest rates went up by 1%. The average price of a house in Australia went up by 12.5%. If you'd have asked me a couple of years ago, interest rates will go up by 1%, house prices will go up by 12.5%, I would have said, yeah, right. No chance of that happening. But it has, because there is this huge imbalance between supply and demand. Everybody knows when you have a huge imbalance between supply and demand, your price goes up. And that's basically what's happening. And we've got this rising deficit that's coming up year after year after year. Why is that? Well, the federal government has been the one fueling the demand with immigration and maybe bonuses and that kind of thing. That's good. And then they say, here you go, states, you can deal with the supply. And by the way, we're not going to coordinate who does what. And if you come to the finance, that's good. No coordination at the federal level until recently. And then the states do these big plans, metropolitan plans and so on, some better than others. And then give it to the local governments to be play guard and work out what goes where. The whole thing's wrong. You've got this total disconnect between the supply and the demand. And that's why we're in this problem now. What's the federal government done? It's appointed a minister for housing. Haven't had one of those for 14 years. Fantastic. She, Tanya Plibersek, will do an outstanding job. Smart, dynamic, and she knows that we have a major problem here with this whole housing affordability, which is what we're talking about. They will get on with it, that's good. And again, the horse is bolted. We're playing catch-up here. If they press the button on rezoning things and getting things going, working through the planning system as quickly as you can, you're talking 3 or 4 years, at which time that deficit has grown to a level that is unsustainable. You turn a housing affordability issue into a housing affordability crisis. I said to her, we should say nothing. Let it all happen. Profit margins through the roof, shareholders happy, but it's not sustainable. It runs out of steam at some stage. Why is that? Affordability. Supply and demand is fine. Prices go up, unless you can't afford it. When your consumer gets to the point where they can't afford it, then they stop buying. And they do that because it has affordability. It used to be that Sydney was very far too expensive, Melbourne was a bit behind and quite cheap. Everything is now just as unaffordable as everywhere else. All about the same. Not quite like it was in the late 1980s, thankfully, when interest rates were at 17%, but it's still very, very tough from an affordability perspective. By any international measure, and this is, that means bad news on this one, by any international measure, our housing affordability is not good. And if you look at what's driven that, you know, with rising interest rates, mortgage repayments are now, on average across the country, 2.5 times rents. People can't afford to buy because the mortgage repayments are so high, because of house prices being high, and because of interest rates being high. So what do they do instead? They rent. Problem is, that's driven the rental vacancy rate down to around about 1%. 1%, that's just frictional churn. Advertisements for rental property in most CBDs have plummeted. That's because you don't have to advertise. There is a queue. There are auction rentals going on. You know, advertise for 500 a week and you know, people are bidding from there. Because you can't afford to buy, you go into rent, the vacancy rates are coming down, there's nowhere to rent, and guess what? Rents are going up. I've gone from feeling sorry for the people in our home ownership who can't afford it to feeling sorry for the renters who are getting squeezed. Every 6 months your rent goes up. And it's almost at the stage now where most capital cities will be in a position where rents will be going by double digits. Great for the owners, but you know, what about the poor people who have to rent themselves? So something has to give. And what's given is that middle Australia, the people who voted at the last election, are now very angry. Time to buy a building, it's plummeted. I don't want to buy, not a good time to buy. But I have to, because of this population growth. You know, new immigrants coming to the country, 180,000 of them, what do they do? Pitch a tent. They've got to buy. Or the bill of rent, and they're very angry as a result. The anger index, as we call it in our sales offices, you know, we're at the coalface of residential, the anger index where you get angry buyers has gone up. People who are just feeling real anxiety because they can't afford to buy anymore. You can just feel it. People talk about, well, the interest and the tax, people who turn around, and they do. You get another fantastic UBS chart. Higher interest rates. This is the overall bill that comes out of higher interest is assumed that rates stay pretty stable now. $16 billion a year in additional impost. There's the tax. This year, about $16 billion of additional income. Zero-sum game. Problem is, the green line is the share of the tax cuts that go to mortgage holders. So they're the ones getting smoked with the big interest rate rises, and they're the people who are getting, you know, only a certain share of the tax break. Real pain. So what does it mean for us? Strong fundamentals, supply and demand, but a caution that the consumer is hurting. And a caution that the consumer is hurting has an impact on our business, obviously, with retail sales in our shopping centres and our residential buyers. Wheels aren't falling off, we've still got buyers. If that's all fine, but there is just a caution out there that the consumer has had enough and has been moving that pretty well. Despite these strong fundamentals, supply and demand imbalance, everybody's been crunched. You know, it's just a correction, it's the Centro contagion, it's all of those things, and our prices come up as well. But it's all relative as well. That's the chart that in times like this is probably more important. That's a relative game, and on relative terms, we've performed really well. It doesn't look much on the graph, but the difference between the blue line and the red line, which is our competitor set, is about $3 billion worth of value. So we're very proud of that. That's the value that we've created compared with our competitors over the last few years. Why? Strong balance sheet. That's how you're relative to the sector average. 12 months ago, I used to get embarrassed by that. Not embarrassed by the chart, but you put it up. Lazy balance sheet, not high enough gearing. Why don't you increase your gearing? Because at that rate, you can boost your earnings per share. That's right. You don't even need any other shoe to pack up that place to work that out. But is it the right thing to do? Gearing is good when debt is cheap. When debt's expensive, gearing isn't good. The problem is, when debt becomes more expensive, how do you get your gearing down? Especially in vehicles like Oscar's Property Trust, where we have a very high payout ratio, how do you get your gearing down? Answer is, keep it low in the first place, then you don't have to worry about it. Cop the flag. Yeah. 2 years ago, our finance reps used to cop flag. Lazy balance sheet, bad capital management. This is the chart that nobody used to care about. Now, not just the debt, but the term of the debt. You know, we put the slide up there, weighted average maturity, 6-7 years, blah, 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 who cares? And now everybody cares. It's the first one that voted. What's your average debt maturity? To 3 decimal places. Because that's what counts now. The bubble size here is not size of entity, it's size of debt. And you can see that there's a lot of debt out there, and also a lot of debt that's going to have to be repaid in the next 2 to 3, 4 years, with a gearing level that is already very high. Danger zone. I'm happy that we're out there on the top right-hand corner. We've also grown our profit strongly. Another graph that we're very, very proud of, but one that we need to keep on working very, very hard to achieve, not setting the expectations too high. We gave our guidance for the 2008 financial year last August. 5%. At the time, it was, you know, low-balling. Got it all up your sleeve, 5%. Gee, you should be able to do better than that. Downgrade, hasn't met expectations. We're expecting it to be 6. What is it now? 5%. Good number. Well, you've got to be happy with that, haven't you? You know, it's like just the mood swings very, very quickly. You've got to make sure that the corporate mood is a long-term one, that your mood doesn't change. You just stick to your knitting, continue on your path, and don't get hijacked by short-termism in the market, higher debt, pump it too hard, and just ignore them. And if that means that there are times when, you know, you get a downgrade or one of those things, fine. Live with it. Don't play to the market. It always ends up in tears. We also look after our people. A slide that is currently at about number 45 in our investor pack every 6 months. A slide that, if it went for the credit crunch, would already be there, but certainly in 2 or 3 years' time, we'll be slide number one. Never mind the financial stuff, that's fine, we understand that. What are you doing to retain your people? What's your capability? Because this shortage of talent is only going to get worse. And it's not one of those things you can wake up one morning and think, oh, we've got a talent shortage, we're going to ask the people. You've got to build it up and have it as a very much a long-term focus of the organisation. Same with sustainability. You can't be coming at this from an after event. This is slide 46 at the moment. It'll probably be slide number 2. What about freight train coming? I mean, it's probably hit us. You know, Roscano speaking recently. I mean, it's there. We're in long-dated assets where we have to recognise now that the rules of engagement for the future are changing as we speak. We actually don't know what the rules are, but it's all changing. It's about caring about your footprint and taking a long-term view and caring about what you do, all of your stakeholders. You know, it's gone from being a triple bottom line, blah, blah issue in the marketplace to one that is now an absolute necessity. this whole thing calms and so on. I could come out tomorrow and say we'll be carbon neutral. All we've got to do is plant a few trees. Become carbon neutral. I mean, what is that? What purpose does that serve? Yeah. Number one in carbon neutrality, you plant a lot of trees, so what? It's ridiculous. You know, we've actually got to cut through all of the noise here and have a real focus on what the long-term issues are and deal with the longer-term issues. So in summary, the credit crunch, a major concern, still has some way to go. It's a long way from over. It's moved beyond the subprime. That's not a subprime issue. It's a credit crunch, it's a liquidity crunch, and it's a long, long way from over. We're all being impacted. Property fundamentals are strong, purely on the supply of demand. And we're in good shape to deal with that. But we are cautious about the consumer. How will we deal with this? By keeping on doing what we're doing and doing it well. It's not a time for, you know, new strategic directions going off at a tangent, doing new stuff. It's about just sticking to knitting and doing it well.